You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 23rd of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Midori House and also just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
They went in on Saturday lunchtime, very heavily armed. They've really sort of dug in for the fight. And when the Kenyan military tried to go in yesterday afternoon, they almost immediately sustained 3 casualties.
Night has fallen in Nairobi and the siege at the Kenyan capital's Westgate Mall continues 3 days after the attack began. Jane Kinnamont and Gregory Beichman will be here live to discuss the appeal of soft targets for terrorist groups. Kenya wasn't the only country to suffer a horrendous attack this weekend. A suicide bombing claimed the lives of more than 80 people at a church in Peshawar. We will study the consequences of that atrocity too.
This attack is no doubt horrific, as it is sad. Here we are seeing yet again another vulnerable community being subjected to a terrible and violent attack that some say could be preventable if the will is there.
In the second half, we'll head down to the Monocle Cafe. Today, we'll hear from Swiss design guru Yves Behar on how to merge high-tech, sleek design with sustainable results.
Humble projects that come across have turned for me sometimes as being the more impactful ones. I never got up in the morning and said, I really wish I worked on a shoebox.
We'll also have music from Just a Band, the author of a new book, The Meaningful Brand, and a look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo right now with me, Steve Bloomfield. I almost made that rhyme there at the end. A lot coming up in the next hour here on Aperitivo, but before that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Thick smoke is pouring out from the besieged Nairobi Mall, where Kenyan officials said their forces were closing in on Islamists holding hostages, 3 days after a raid by Somalia's al-Shabaab killed at least 62 people, injuring 175. 2 terrorists are now confirmed dead. News is coming in that almost all of the hostages have now been evacuated and that the remaining militants are still hiding in the Westgate shopping centre. Al-Shabaab said they carried out the attack because of Kenya's intervention in Somalia, where it's now working alongside other African peacekeeping troops to push back Islamic militants. An Australian woman who was among the survivors has described her experience during the escape. Heidi Edwards, a lawyer working with the Kenya Human Rights Commission, said she hid when it initially dawned on her what all the noise was.
There was some panic going on and then another one in quick succession and some gunshots. And we were telling everyone to get down. Then I decided to try the staff door. There's a staff-only door. Luckily, that was unlocked. So we got quite a few people through there, closed that and just ran.
Well, the International Criminal Court has adjourned the war crimes trial of the Vice President, William Ruto, for a week so that he can return to Kenya to deal with the crisis. The adjournment was requested by his lawyer, Karim Khan.
It is essential, we say, for the William Ruto to go back. One wouldn't have expected, or the world would have found it intolerable, if the President and Vice President of the United States were not in the country after 9/11. Well, this is Kenya's 9/11.
A jailed member of Russia's Pussy Riot punk band said she was starting a hunger strike today to protest against what she called slave labour in her penal colony and said she had received a death threat from a senior prison official. Nadazhda Tolokonikova was sentenced to 2 years in jail in August 2012 after performing what the band called a punk prayer in a Moscow cathedral in protest against President Vladimir Putin amid mass street protests against his rule. Germany's current Europe policy will not change, Chancellor Angela Merkel has said after her landslide election victory. She won a historic third term in office. Her Christian Democrat Party won 41.5% of the vote, not quite enough for an absolute majority. Almut Muller from the German Council on Foreign Relations says Chancellor Merkel's victory came at a price with the loss of her Liberal Democrat allies.
Certainly for Germany, this is something very significant and very new. The Liberal Democrats are not going to be in the next parliament, which changes fundamentally coalition dynamics and also the discussions that will be happening in parliament. So I'm sure that apart from those that were campaigning for the FDP, there will be quite a few people waking up in Germany today thinking, oh, maybe that's not really what we wanted in the end.
The trial of Captain Francesco Scatino, who's charged over the sinking of the Costa Concordia, resumed today when he addressed judges in court in Tuscany. He faces multiple charges, including manslaughter, causing a shipwreck and abandoning ship after the Concordia, carrying more than 4,000 passengers and crew, struck a reef off the Tuscan island of Giglio and capsized with the loss of 32 lives on the 13th of January last year. He has admitted responsibility for the accident, but he accused the helmsman of not following orders and causing a fatal 13-second steering delay as the ship was approaching the rocks. And staying in Italy, Pope Francis brought laughter to a crowd of young people when he told them he was not Tarzan, but gets his staying power during times of difficulty from his faith. Speaking off the cuff at the end of a trip to Sardinia, he said he had recently marked the 60th anniversary of the day he first felt the vocation to be a priest. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich,
London, London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monaco, Paris, Chechnya.
From London,
London, London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Aperitivo. It's 18.06 here in London. It's 13.06 in New York City. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Gregory Beichmann, Global Head of Multimedia at Reuters. Welcome both of you to the programme. We begin today in Nairobi. The attack on the Westgate Mall has shocked Kenyans, but it hasn't necessarily surprised them. For several years, there have been warnings that Somali Islamist groups might commit such an atrocity. Coffee shops, bars and shopping malls have all been mentioned as possible targets. Westgate itself has been the subject of numerous warnings from Western embassy security officials. In a moment, we'll talk to Jane and Greg about the way such terrorist groups all over the world have taken advantage of soft targets. First, though, let's hear from our Nairobi correspondent, Tristan McConnell, who's been outside Westgate all weekend.
You know, the danger of an attack like this really increased about 2 years ago when the Kenyan army moved into Somalia in order to try to push Al-Shabaab out of the south of the country. They're now part of the African Union force there. And immediately that invasion took place. There were very direct threats issued by Al-Shabaab saying, we're going to bring the war to Kenya and you're never going to be safe. And that's been reiterated by Al-Shabaab via its Twitter account over the last couple of days since this assault and siege began. In terms of the capacity to stop this kind of thing, I think it's very difficult.
As Tristan says there, Jane, this sort of thing is really difficult to stop. This isn't an aeroplane where there's all sorts of security before you even get into the airport, let alone before you get on the plane. This is coffee shops and supermarkets. We can't have metal detectors and blast walls outside those sorts of places, can we?
Well, every country makes a choice about what kind of security costs they're willing to take. But sure, I mean, we're sitting here discussing this today in London. The Tube in London has been the target of terrorist attacks before. And yet the prospect of having security checks on the way onto the Tube is, frankly, too much of a hassle for Britain to consider. So often the focus is more on intelligence, on trying to preempt attacks, rather than trying to search everybody.
And Greg, the attack that this incident brings to mind most is the one in Mumbai in 2008. You were there in the city when that happened. I imagine this brings back certain memories.
Absolutely. I think one of the key things that stands out is, you know, you have a lot of parallels with India. You have a strengthening Kenyan economy. You have probably a growing number of expats and a level of affluence and certainly certain levels of Kenyan society. A similar scenario in India, and people in Mumbai at the time, and people go to these places for some respite, some taste of the West, if you will, and some taste of a more developed economy, air-conditioned malls, boutiques, all the kinds of Western things you'd expect, like coffee shops and restaurants are all there. They become the hub of conversation for many of the people associated with the sort of rising economies that you have in Kenya and in India. And so a lot of parallels there. It's a very soft target. Interestingly, we mentioned before about security, you know, after it happened in 2008, they did put in metal detectors. They did do bag searches, but none of this would really stop a serious group of people with heavy weapons trying to enter a building.
And the other comparison, of course, is Luxor and the attack there in 1997, Jane. I mean, when after that happened, obviously there was, there was a lot of talk about the sort of security measures you could take. Mm. But it hasn't necessarily meant that, you know, people still go on holiday to Egypt.
Absolutely. Egypt's tourism has tended to be really resilient. So within a year, basically in the year after the Luxor massacre, tourists stayed away. But after that, people took advantage of discounts. They kind of forgot about it. They started to come back. I mean, globally, we haven't seen the global tourism industry really struggle as a result of the increased perceptions of terrorist threats after 9/11. People often have short memories. They have some level of risk tolerance.
I mean, that's the good thing, isn't it? Ultimately, most of these attacks don't really have the long-term impact that they want. I think in this case, you know, you will see pressure on the Kenyan government to try to stop what's a very poor, you know, try to control a very porous border, and also probably crack down on some of the groups that are in its own, among its own people, who seem to be supporting some of these kinds of activities. I think that's one of the things that we saw in India as well, was a strengthening of security. But at the end of the day, it's almost impossible to stop this sort of attack in a place like Kenya.
It's difficult to have this sort of conversation while the siege is still going on and there are people still inside. But in a way, the fact that these incidents are so rare, and you know, if we take Kenya for example, there have been, you know, there have been warnings ever since, you know, 2006, when the Islamic courts first retook power inside Somalia, and Western countries, including the US and the UK, were very active in trying to get them out. And that was when there were the initial threats against coffee shops in Nairobi, and that was 7 years ago, and nothing happened. Does the fact that these are so rare, Jane, in a way sort of make you think, well, okay, it's horrible, it's horrendous, but you know, this is, we'll just have to get through this?
It's always important to bear in mind that groups of this sort are often firmly in the minority. At the end of the day, Kenya's a country where a huge number of poor people depend on tourism. You saw the same thing in Egypt with the reaction to the Luxor massacre. It was something that created outrage among Egyptians. And even earlier this year, you saw the fallout continue. Mohamed Morsi, when he was president, decided to appoint a new governor of Luxor. And he was taken from Gamma Islamiyya, which was the group that had carried out the Luxor attacks. Now, the group says it's reformed, it's repented, it was very sorry about the attacks, it's come up as a new, supposedly changed organisation. But nonetheless, the people of Luxor were up in arms, saying this is at best insensitive, at worst really appalling. And that was actually one of the things that helped to make Morsi so unpopular that the military were able to overthrow him in July.
I think the odd thing is, if you think about it, most terror initiatives really don't achieve. I mean, what's going on right now is not a plan to sort of survive the attack by the people carrying out the attack by holding hostages. That is simply an attempt to drag out the show on media. The reality is, though, once the media show's over, there has been, I think, very little political change, barring what happened in Spain after those attacks there, where you had the president thrown out.
But that was very different, though, wasn't it?
Very
different.
Because
in Spain, the issue wasn't that people were reacting necessarily to the terrorist attack. Mm. It was also reacting to the fact that the Spanish government at the time, first of all, claimed it was ETA when they knew full well it was Al Qaeda. Mm. And then they were, and the state TV was running cartoons rather than news. I think there was the story that somehow the Spanish people thought, well, I'm going to change my vote because of this. I think
I would throw in the Iraq debate there as well. Mm. But ultimately, I think it's true that ultimately these attacks don't really have a tremendous impact on political decisions, and generally they result in a more resilient society not a weakened one. So exactly what the logic of carrying it out is, I think this is actually a question that doesn't get easily answered, that behind the people actually backing these things.
When we look at the way the media reacts to this, and Greg, I want to bring you into this as well in a moment. Jane, do you think that we still haven't quite worked out what the best thing to do here is, because you know you had lots of people who were there who were tweeting exactly what was happening. Had lots of people reporting the tweets from the allegedly from the Al Shabaab Twitter account. There were some really quite gruesome pictures in some newspapers. The New York Times, for example, quite happy to show pictures of dead people because they weren't Americans. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there needs to be a little bit more responsibility from the media in terms of how we cover something like this?
Well, it's a dilemma for the media. I mean, at the end of the day, most of the papers are in the business of selling papers. They know that people can go online and see the full graphic.
And we're all reading it and we're all watching it.
So. Absolutely. And they've had, similar dilemmas over Syria. How much do you show, really gruesome pictures of the gas attacks and so forth? Well, a lot of outlets have made the call that people can see it on YouTube and they might as well show it. But there is always that issue with terrorism. People use the phrase the oxygen of publicity. Are you focusing sometimes too much attention on these attacks, often because they do involve Westerners? So you see headlines here in Britain particularly referring to British tourists that are caught up in it. That's a natural reaction. People wonder if something like this could affect someone that they know. But it also gives you a slightly incorrect perception about, where is the majority of violence actually taking place? Who really does suffer from these things?
Greg, what sort of discussions do you have at Reuters over this in terms of, what you think you should show, what you shouldn't, what you should say, what you shouldn't?
I think that it's a tough back and forth. Certainly when we had things like the beheadings going on in Iraq, there was a very strong debate there. And we tried different things like blurring the video. We tried sort of running it up until the moment it happened. We tried different things. I think the truth is some of this is slipping a little bit away from the mainstream media because, in fact, anyone who puts a photo up on Twitter, is effectively able to broadcast it out to a very wide audience. So it's a rock and a hard place for mainstream media organizations. They want to remain relevant for their audiences. They want to bring value to them. I think, they have a tough choice. Does the violent image tell a story? Is it important to have an impact on the audience that follows them that way? I think it's a play. There's no real hard, fast way of playing it. I know that when we put out gratuitous scenes, and I think the same goes for other media organizations, we warn people in newsrooms, we warn viewers that this is gratuitous violence, and you may not want to be exposed to it. But I'm not sure it's something that even the mainstream media can really control, and that's why how they grapple with it. If it was only the mainstream media reaching an audience right now, I think it'd be easier. There would be standards as there previously were. Mm. In this scenario, tweet a photo of a body. Who knows if you type Kenya into your Twitter search, you've got that photo, and then you've got a New York Times article.
Is there not a responsibility if you're, say, New York Times or Reuters if you're going to decide to print a photo, then that has more weight than if my sister does it?
I think generally that's true. There's a responsibility, but I think the responsibility is to the audience that trusts that brand and to ensure that it's worth having. It shouldn't just be there to show them blood and gore. It should be that this is exactly what the blast looked like, and you should understand that this was a giant crater. Just for example, when we've seen, a drone strike or something, and we've seen images of that, there is a responsibility there. But I think it's something that cannot be answered in a single policy diktat. And I know from working in newsrooms and even talking to customers and partners that the rules are not fixed. I think the question about whether Westerners are shown is a really important one. And there's no doubt in the US they self-censor. And in many countries they self-censor. I think in Britain, certainly in Japan, there's a resistance to showing dead Japanese bodies in Japanese media. So that's almost a cultural one. But you could argue it has other racial tones and things to it as well.
And Jane, just finally, you mentioned the attacks here in London before and about people going back on the tube. And it was astonishing, actually, how pretty much everyone went back straight back on the tube almost the next day. And the idea of even having metal detectors outside tube stations was laughed at because everyone's like, well, no, we want to get to work. How important is it that the you know, once something like this is over, that you try to get back to normal as quickly as possible?
I think it's incredibly important. We were talking earlier, Greg raised the point about what does terrorism achieve strategically? And actually, a lot of it is in the power of the society where the attacks happen. To what extent do you change your practices? To what extent do you even sacrifice your values? My personal impression is that in Britain, people were aware that after 9/11, there had been new restrictions brought in on our freedoms, that there were that increased the chances of Britain getting involved in Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. And I think, you know, politicians like the Mayor of London at the time talked about the importance of not letting the attacks destroy the social fabric of London, not being paranoid or racist in the response. And I think those words at that time really resonated.
Okay, we're going to leave it just there for now. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'm here with Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Gregory Beichmann from Reuters. When we return, we'll discuss yesterday's bombing in Peshawar, one of the worst attacks on Christians in Pakistan.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whisky connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whisky, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And you're back with Aperitivo. It's 1921 in Madrid, 1821 here in London, and 1221 in Mexico City. Still with me are Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, and Gregory Beichmann, Global Head of Multimedia at Reuters. We move from Nairobi to the scene of another devastating attack that took place yesterday, this time in the northern Pakistani city of Peshawar. The attack on a church that claimed at least 80 lives came just 2 weeks after Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's announcement that the government was ready to open fresh peace talks with the Taliban. However, this latest incident seems to clearly signal that the Taliban and groups linked to it remain committed to continuing their armed struggle. A little earlier, we caught up with Monocle's regular contributor in Pakistan, Samira Shackle, who explained why religious persecution, especially of Christian minorities, remains rife in the country.
The attack that happened yesterday is the worst attack against Christians in Pakistan's history. But if you look at the way that Christians and other minorities are treated routinely, I think it stops being such a surprise that this attack happens and starts to seem more like a matter of time before it did. I think Christians in particular are constantly having to prove to the wider society that they are Pakistani at all. And that's a view sort of really perpetrated by militant groups, but it does also spread across society. I think there's a leftover of the Hindu caste system is that you know, many Christians in Pakistan had converted from the lowest caste of Hinduism pre-partition. And as a leftover from that, there's a sort of view that they're unclean, that you shouldn't share with them. And so all those attitudes can come to the forefront in a very ugly way at difficult times. And I think that's been seen in sort of mixed responses to the attack. I mean, obviously, the general reaction is one of disgust, but you've also got television news networks falling short of calling them Shaheed, which means martyr, another word that's generally used, another word that's used often for victims of terrorist violence. And you've also got others in quite mainstream media outlets sort of repeating almost what the terrorists who did the attack have said, which is that this is a retaliation for drone strikes. And I mean, what is a group of sort of parish in Peshawar and northwestern Pakistan, most of whom will never have left Peshawar, let alone left Pakistan, have to do with drone strikes at all? They're being punished for a crime they haven't committed.
Samira Shackle there, and for a little perspective on exactly what sort of damage this threatens to wreak on the nascent peace process, here's Al Jazeera's correspondent in the country, Imtiaz Tayeb.
This attack is no doubt horrific, as it is sad, but it really highlights a number of key issues facing Pakistan on several fronts. Of course, here we are seeing yet again another vulnerable community being subjected to a terrible and violent attack that some say could be preventable if the will is there. Now, speaking of will, we need to look at where in Pakistan this attack is taking place. It is the city of Peshawar. Peshawar, of course, is no stranger to violence, but we really haven't seen this kind of violence directed towards the minority Christian community before. And it really raises bigger questions about the ability of the government in that province to keep minorities and indeed your average citizens safe as well. Now, the reason it's significant is because in May of this year, the Pakistan Tehreek Insaf Party, or the Movement for Justice Party, a party led by Imran Khan, swept in on this message of hope and change. But this bombing really, again, just underscores how some of Pakistan's old demons are all too easily bubbling to the surface. But what this also, frankly, highlights is the fact that although there has been much talk about the federal government, the government led by the Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, and its efforts to normalize relations with the Taliban, to get the Taliban to the peace table, is frankly falling apart.
That was Imtiaz Taib. Greg, it's difficult sometimes with all sorts of groups to work out what exactly it is they want. It's even harder in this situation in Pakistan, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Pakistan the reality is problems have been exacerbated post 9/11 with drone attacks, with the kind of cross-border activity carried out by the Taliban. But the truth is many of these problems lie back in its origin. It was a country that was, you know, forced together in many ways and brings together a bunch of different ethnic groups, some of whom really don't like each other. I've spent time in that part of Pakistan. I was always struck by how people complained about the Punjab, not referring to Indian Punjab, but referring to Pakistan Punjab. The motivations here, I think you're looking at extremist groups who think of the Christians in a very simplistic way as representing the West, being aligned with the West. The reality is, as the reporter points out, most of them are converted low-caste Hindus. And even though Pakistan is a Muslim country, there's still quite a bit of the old caste system left around in society, in landlords controlling things indentured servants or farmers who don't own land, who are forced to work that land. A lot of problems in the society. And of course, it's all become a bit of a pressure cooker in the NWFP with the drone strikes, with the cross-border activity and the Taliban.
And Jane, the use of drone strikes as some sort of reason for why this happens, It's very easy, isn't it, for people to go, there's reasons why these groups do this, is because we're doing things to them. If we just stop that, then it'll all be, it'll all stop. But often in cases like this, it's just a useful excuse, isn't it?
It's certainly a popular bandwagon to leap on. Imran Khan was mentioned, and a big part of his campaign was vehemently expressing opposition to US drone strikes. So yeah, it's a popular cause, but obviously there are plenty of other ways, including through elected representatives, to try to make this point, and no real excuse for scapegoating the Christian community. And it is part of a bigger picture of intolerance in Pakistan. There have been a lot of murders of Shia Pakistanis as well in recent months.
It's a very easy, low-hanging fruit target. The reality is there aren't many targets left in the NWFP which they can strike. I think it's got to be brought out here. This is a simple, soft target, and it's very sad to see.
And Jane, when we look at the whole sweep of the region from Pakistan all the way through to North Africa, it's very hard to find anything good to say about the lives of Christians in the region now, is it?
Well, there's a lot of sad stories. If we look at Iraq, if we look at Egypt, albeit not nearly so violent, but certainly anxious and tense, and also if we look at Syria, there's a lot of reasons for Christian communities in the region to feel that it's a bad time for them. And it can put Western governments in a difficult position. Sometimes Arab Christians are saying to Western governments, don't speak up for us too much, because they don't want to be associated with the West. They want to be seen as equal local citizens.
And yet also, Greg, you then get some politicians in the West who get particularly exercised about attacks on Christians.
There's no doubt about it, particularly in the United States with the evangelical community. I mean, They haven't quite stood up and supported Assad, who has, you know, there's been this nun who's sort of said she supports Assad and thinks the gas attacks were fabricated. But it does raise pressure. And I think in places like Egypt, there have been real questions. You saw a U.S. Congressional delegation was there recently asking some of those same questions about the cops and the condition of the cops. Michelle Bachmann, interestingly.
Michelle Bachmann was there and, yes, asking questions about the cops and then also saying how she supports El-Sisi in his crackdown on and his attempts to restore democracy.
Yes.
And really, we don't have time to get into any of that right now. Jane, a final word when we look at this issue of soft targets from the shopping mall to the church. Is there really any way around this other than just accepting that it might happen every now and then, and we have to decide, do we change our way of life and, for example, you know, do you therefore, you know, pray in secret and don't go to church? Or do you have blast walls outside shopping centres? Or you just accept that this is how life is going to be?
There's got to be a balance. You need to try to preempt these things, but you need to reduce the incentives for terrorism by saying that this doesn't work. And often the thing that terrorist groups are wanting to achieve is a big change in your behaviour, to use your strength against you. So overreacting can actually perpetuate the problem.
Okay, I think we'll leave it there. Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Gregory Beichmann, Global Head of Multimedia at Reuters. Thank you both very much indeed. We're going to be changing pace slightly in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk design with Yves Behar, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily, amongst other things. Oh, also, we'll be playing some great music from Kenya, just to show that, you know, there is some good stuff there at the moment. But before we get started on that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Thanks very much. Thick smoke is pouring out from the besieged Nairobi Mall, where Kenyan officials said their forces were closing in on Islamists holding hostages 3 days after a raid by Somalia's al-Shabaab killed at least 62 people, injuring 175 people. Two terrorists are now confirmed dead. A jailed member of Russia's Pussy Riot punk band said she was starting a hunger strike today to protest against what she called slave labour in her penal colony, and said she'd received a death threat from a senior prison official. Germany's current European policy will not change, Chancellor Angela Merkel has said after her landslide election victory. She won a historic third term in office. Her Christian Democratic Party won 41.5% of the vote, which is not quite enough for an absolute majority. And the trial of Captain Francesco Schettino, who's charged over the sinking of the Costa Concordia, resumed today when he addressed judges in court in Tuscany. He has admitted responsibility for the accident, but he accused the helmsman of not following orders and causing a fatal 13-second steering delay as the ship was approaching the rocks. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Aperitivo live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, and 14:32 in Rio. Time now to head down to the Monocle Cafe. Yves Behar is the founder of San Francisco-based design agency Fuse Project. Here's with the team behind the world's first $100 laptop. That's the one laptop per child scheme. They also helped to create Jawbone's wireless Jambox speaker, Herman Miller's Leaf Light, and most recently, a beverage carbonator for SodaStream, which aims to tackle our overconsumption of disposable soda bottles. You didn't even know it was a problem, did you? Editor Andrew Tuck met Yves at the Monocle Cafe earlier on today.
Now, Yves, you're in London for the launch of the kind of next generation of SodaStream, a really interesting product that many people will know from 20 years ago when they were kids. It was something that kind of then kind of vanished out of kitchens. Your involvement in it is interesting on many levels, because you kind of see it as a bit of a green product in many senses, as well as being a beautiful object to have in your house.
Well, first of all, it's amazing to launch SodaStream here in London, and we've done it a year ago with the first one, Source, and with the second one called Play, because people have so many memories. Everybody grew up here with a SodaStream, so you're really tapping into people's childhood memories. But the brand was, you know, really almost went away and got revived in the last 4 or 5 years. The other one is, you know, sustainability or at least sort of, you know, giving people the opportunity to consume in new ways simply by not having to throw, you know, bottles away.
Do you think you're a designer in particular who believes that design can do good in the world? You've been involved with this project of the $100 laptop. Mm-hmm. Many of the products you make, they do have a kind of an understanding about sustainability. Mm-hmm. Is that a fundamental tenet of everything you do?
Whether it's implicit, whether it's, you know, a part of the story, or whether it's not, sometimes it's just a, you know, more discreet version of that. I do think it's absolutely critical that designers see themselves part of the whole world, not just a world of luxury or a world of consumption or a world of furniture, but whether, you know, the whole world around them. You know, whether it's the clever little bag, you know, the new Puma shoebox, or whether it's the one laptop per child, I think there is a tremendous opportunity for us to, first of all, participate at a wider level. You know, have a conversation with the developing world, have a conversation with mainstream supermarket level. I mean, it's important for us to be a part of those environments. And when we are doing things at a large scale, to have a level of consciousness and provide a level of consciousness for people who use and buy what we make.
Now, you set a very interesting kind of borderline between technology and design. Mm-hmm. Could you run your business today anywhere else than San Francisco?
That's a very good question. So I grew up in Europe. I grew up in Switzerland. I think that for me, moving to California 20 years ago really was a mind-opening experience. You know, I grew up in a place like Switzerland where change and what's new isn't the driving part of the culture. And then suddenly you're in Silicon Valley in San Francisco, and people absolutely don't want to do the same thing that's been done before. They have zero interest in that. They all want to prove that there is a new way or a different way. You know, they all want to show that it's possible to achieve something through different means and new means. A lot of them are technological, obviously. But, you know, San Francisco has also had a tradition of completely new types of businesses before technology. You know, the gold rush, in a sense, is one that this notion of just going out there and trying something and taking risks is something that has been there for quite a long time. Technology is the latest iteration of it, but before that you had, you know, Levi's jeans. You had incredible entrepreneurs that have always been there. I mean, there's many reasons why it's a very special place where essentially ideas are, you know, what people want to hear, what they want to talk about, new ideas. And shoving aside the old ideas is a daily sport.
Tell me, do you feel drawn to some of the bigger ambitions of a designer? Do you have, when you drive down the highway, do you think, I wouldn't mind doing a car, or I wouldn't mind doing some architecture now? Do you have an idea to go beyond the product?
So as a designer, I don't spend my life looking around and saying how terrible everything is. I think it would be a sad life. I also don't spend my time thinking that my work would be so much better or so much bigger if I worked on an airplane or if I worked on a car. I think that would be a sad life as well. Sometimes some very humble projects come across my desk and my office, such as designing a shoebox. And so humble projects that come across have turned for me sometimes as being the more impactful ones. So, you know, I never got up in the morning and said, I really wish I worked on a shoebox. But at the same time, you know, those, I think, make the bigger difference.
And finally, returning to an idea you had at the very top of this conversation about the idea of speed, about our desire to have things now. I know you're also designing a coffee station called House, where you can kind of pre-order your coffee and it can register the kind of coffee you want and it will always be available for you.
Right.
Does that mean that today a designer cannot be kind of an isolated person to do a product that you know, you sit in San Francisco, as we said, but you need to have partnership with tech firms and other people outside of your world as well?
So I actually started with, you know, the name of my office is Fuse Project, and the notion right from the beginning was to fuse all these different disciplines, because I saw in 98-99 when I started, I saw that it wasn't going to be possible to just do projects from a singular point of view without really addressing all the facets, all the impacts, all the experiential opportunities. So technically and also spiritually, I felt that all these different disciplines would add tremendously to the outcomes, you know, to a customer's or user's experience. So for me, like, design really is about the entire experience. If it's mechanically not resolved, or if it's experientially or digitally not resolved, then you really only using, you know, a small portion of the tools that are available to you as a designer today to deliver something, you know, important.
And that was designer Eve Bihar with Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck down at the cafe. Having a bit of a flat white there as well. Next up, we'll consider how brands drive value for businesses. What is it that makes some brands successful and others, well, you know, just not? Stay tuned to find out more here on Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London with me, Steve Bloomfield, and I've been joined by a guest here in the studio. It's Nigel Hollis, who's Executive Vice President at WPP's brand research agency, Millward Brown. Later this month, in fact, next month, October indeed, he's releasing his second book entitled The Meaningful Brand, a collection of research that builds upon his first book and discusses how businesses can harness their brands to drive financial growth. Also, it says here, Nigel, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
So the meaningful brand is this one. The last one, though, was the global brand. What's the difference between a global brand and a meaningful brand?
Well, if you want to be successful on the global scale, you better have a meaningful brand. So
this is slightly cart before the horse.
Exactly. we're going backwards in time, as it were, to create a strong and successful brand, which then you should extend around the world if you can.
And what is it that, well, let's start with the most basic question. What is it that makes a meaningful brand? Because it's, you know, brand is a word that gets thrown out an awful lot. I mean, the number of press releases I get, which have the word brand in it, and I'm the foreign editor. So, you know, God knows how many press releases our design editor gets with this. It's one of those words that is kind of almost overused. What for you is it then a meaningful brand, and how do you get one?
Well, a meaningful brand is one that actually resonates with the customer or the consumer that it's targeted toward. And, you know, the problem is brands are intangible. They exist in people's heads as a set of ideas and associations, feelings, memories. And so they're tough to pin down on occasion. And what might actually be meaningful to you might be different for me. And the challenge for marketers and brand builders is to find something common that attracts and appeals to both of us.
I want to talk about a couple of examples. I want you to give me a couple of examples. One good, one bad. They don't have to be ones you've necessarily worked on, but, you know, if you want to, that's fine. But let's start with the good. Can you give us a good example of a brand that has really worked, that really is meaningful in that sense?
Well, let's start with something really simple. There's a brand called Chobani, which is a brand of yogurt in the US.
Right.
The US market about 5 to 10 years ago, pretty bland. All the brands are locked into a competitive war. It's all about health, low fat, some functional brands like Activia. And then along
comes... All those ones which sort of say, this is going to do something microbiotic.
Yes, exactly.
Using lots of sort scientific health speak that just makes you think, oh, yeah, I'll have that. I'll feel better.
Precisely.
Yes.
And then they hope you do feel better.
Yes.
Along comes a guy, Turkish immigrant. He was actually running a feta cheese factory. And he goes, you know what? I have yogurt at home. It really tastes of something. And it's rich. And, you know, the fun always amuses me. Turkish guy, and he's selling what's called Greek-style yogurt.
Excellent, good.
But he sets up in business. He buys an old Kraft factory that was manufacturing yogurt. 2 years in development, comes out with this product. It's now a $1.5 billion brand. It has changed the yogurt market in the U.S. beyond belief, because 60% of what is now sold in the U.S. is Greek-style yogurt. So here's a guy, and all his insight was, people might like something rich, creamy, with some taste.
So no focus groups, no sort of market research. Just, we have this thing back in Turkey that's really good. It's far better than what you have here.
Yes, so let me bring it to you. He's one of the key ingredients of a meaningful brand is that someone has passion and purpose. And usually it's not something you can pin down. You have to come from the individual founder of the business. And you look back in time for any brand, you'll find someone who had an idea as to how he could make or she could make people's lives better.
Now, in that entire explanation, you haven't once told us what the packaging looks like, what the logo is, what colours there are. And those are the sorts of things that people often associate with the brand. It's the logo, and it's the look, and it's the design.
Well, and that is a really important part of it, don't get me wrong. But at the end of the day, what are you buying? You're buying something to satisfy a need. There's a functional need of any brand that's got to be satisfied. And then you layer on top of it all of these other things. If you look at the way we respond to the world around us as human beings, we respond emotionally. We also need to be able to recognize stuff. So that's where all the stuff about packaging and logos and that sort of thing comes in, because you've got to recognize the brand to trigger those positive associations that are in your head. But an awful lot of those associations come from actual experience of the product or the brand, not necessarily advertising or marketing.
Okay, that was a good example. Let's look at a bad example, one that really didn't work or failed in some way.
I think there are plenty of brands that have failed along the way. But I'm thinking of the car industry in the US. And there you had plenty of really good brands, but what failed was the business. And all too often, that's what you find, is that the business fails long before the brand ever does. You look at the way that consumers talk about those brands, and it's sort of like slightly wistful. They used to be good.
Yeah.
And now they're not. And usually what's happened is that the brand has failed to keep track of the way that innovation is taking place in the marketplace, and they've been left behind.
Now, if I was trying to hire you right now, I'd be a little bit worried, because I'd be like, well, essentially what you've told me is that you can't do anything for me. It's all down to me and what my business is like.
Ah, but I can do something for you. I can check out whether or not your ideas really do resonate. So to create a meaningful brand experience, one that's different from the alternatives out there, you do have to make sure that it actually resonates with your target consumer. You may think you know what they want, but that's your opinion. And there's lots of other people out there that you have to convince. And that's where I come in, is to make that connection between the two.
Now, just before we came on air while we were playing a little advert, I asked you how long you'd been at at Millwood Brown. You go, oh, you don't want to know. But you then did admit that you were there 30 years ago when it was just 50 people in Leamington Spa, which I should explain is about an hour and a half, 2 hours up from here from London by train, not far from the great city of Birmingham. How has the work you've done developed over those three decades?
Basically, we came up with an approach to monitoring the health of brands that was meaningfully different from what was out there at the time. And that really became the catalyst for expansion. And that's one of the primary things. You come up with something that's better than what's out there and you leverage it, extend it to different geographies and to different categories. So, for instance, these days we have a very big business pre-testing advertising to make sure that it's going to achieve its objectives before people spend a lot of media money behind it.
So there's a number of things that you can do now, which
we wouldn't have been doing 30 years ago. Exactly.
Well, there we are. Nigel Hollis, thank you very much for joining us today. Best of luck with the book. It's called The Meaningful Brand. It's out October the...
22nd.
Okay, in Britain, the US and...
Elsewhere later.
Nigel, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Aperitivo. Now, Saturday night in Nairobi was supposed to see the launch of 10 Cities, a new collaboration between musicians and bands from, as the name suggests, 10 cities in both Europe and Africa. Organised by the Goethe Institute in Nairobi, it was just one of a series of events and collaborations, collabos, as Kenyans like to call them, between Kenyan artists and others in Europe. Understandably, given what happened at Westgate, the event was postponed. It will be back, though, I'm sure. And this is from arguably Kenya's most exciting group, Just a Band. It's Huff and Puff.
I bet it's disco. You got to give me something, and I'll give you something back. I bet it's disco. You got to give me something, and I'll give you something back.
Huff and Puff there by the brilliant Just a Band from Nairobi. It is, what time? Oh, 18:53 here in London. Aperitivo is drawing to a close, but fear not, there is much more still to come on Monocle 24 later on today. We've got the Globus Asia in just over an hour, and then the Monocle Daily 2 hours after that. And the producers of both those shows, Tom Lewis, hello.
Good evening, Steve.
And Barbara Feeney, hello.
Hello, Steve.
Have joined me here in the studio. Tom, let's start with you. You're leading with Nairobi, but we're looking at the Somali angle.
Yes, we are. So obviously we've been bringing updates from Nairobi throughout the day. We'll be checking in with our correspondent, Tristan McConnell there, who will be bringing us the latest. We also spoke to Ken Menkhouse, who's a fellow at the Enough Project. He's written a pretty interesting article looking at what, if this was in fact Al-Shabaab outright who are behind this, what their motivations might be. Now, his thesis, if you like, is that Al-Shabaab is a group on the wane, that this is an act of desperation, in fact. And that's, in essence, what makes this scenario so dangerous and what makes the future of Al-Shabaab and the future of the decisions that are made by Kenya and the Somali governments also quite a precarious situation too.
And Barbara, for the top of the Monocle Daily, we look at the UN General Assembly, aren't we? Which is quite an interesting one this year. Often the speeches are a bit, but this year they're a bit.
I think we're going to look ahead and see, you know, what could we hear this year? We're going to first take a look back to some iconic speeches, have a listen to a bit of Gaddafi, maybe a bit of Chavez.
Yes.
And, you know...
Not all of Gaddafi, though.
No, because, you know...
we don't have that long.
Then we wouldn't have time for the show.
That indeed. Poor translator that year who had to be whisked out halfway through his speech and a replacement put in because he went so long and no one could stop him speaking.
It was not good. But we're going to be, as we said, it's some really interesting actual, you know, state of the world type speeches we're expecting from Obama, Putin, Cameron even.
Yeah, Hollande. Something actually worth listening to, something of interest. So we're going to look ahead with the Reuters UN correspondent and, you know, ask, you know, what can we expect to hear? Is there anything worth listening to?
Indeed. And sort of work out when we should all be sort of watching the live stream of the UN General Assembly, which I'm sure all of you will be doing throughout the week. Tom, we've got a good Good Evening America as well today.
Yes, we have. Yeah, so we always like to check in with one of our correspondents in the Americas, Steve. Tonight we'll be going to Caracas, and one of the stories there, obviously we've been covering these stories from Venezuela since the death of Hugo Chavez, with the straitened times that have befallen the country. Now it seems that country's toy importers are now being embroiled in this. They,
toy importers?
Toy importers, yes. So with Christmas, you know, but a few short months away, there's been this concern that there won't be enough money for the toy importers to import toys for Venezuelans this Christmas. So the government apparently has met with some of the key figures in the toy import industry in Venezuela and has assured them that there will be enough US dollars around for them to be able to supply the children of Venezuela with a Christmas gift this year.
There we are, Nicolas Maduro, like a modern day Santa Claus. Barbara, one final story from the Monocle Daily.
One final story. We're going to take a look through some of the European papers to gauge the reaction to Merkel's re-election.
Yes. So, we've been translating them all day.
Yeah, I kindly translated some of the Irish papers.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem at all. We're going to look at Spain, who, widely kind of an angry reaction. The Irish, Merkel said that we were a country, people should follow our example.
Oh, really?
So some interesting comments in the papers.
There we are. Okay, you've got all that to look forward to. Tom, Barbara, thank you very much indeed. Globus Asia, that's at 2200 hours. Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. That's that, though, for Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our guests, Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Gregory Beichmann from Reuters, who talked us through their take on the events today in both Nairobi and in Pakistan. Here's a little bit of what Jane had to say.
There's got to be a balance. You need to try to preempt these things, but you need to reduce the incentives for terrorism by saying that this doesn't work.
The show today was produced by Tom Edwards and Alexa Firmanich. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next up, after the headlines, we're handing over to Rob Bound for this week's edition of Culture, where we'll take a bit of a European art tour, meet the first person to record and release a rock album in Qatar, of all places. And where else will we be? Of course, at the Ukulele Player of the Year competition here in London.
I'm now 73. And I started playing when I was 65. My advice is very, very simple. There's no magic trick or anything. Practice, practice, practice.
There we are. You've got ages, so you need to take up the ukulele. Then 2200 hours, London time, Globus Asia, as I said, and the daily after that. You know what we've got for the rest of the day. Aperitivo, back at the same time, 800 hours tomorrow. But from all of us here, thank you very much for listening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.